Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, who is a professor of history at Cornell University. He's the author of Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor, The Long Exception, an Interpretation of the New Deal from FDR to Obama, and Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, which received the 2011 Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. His interests focus on workers and the problems of social class in the post-war United States, as well as issues in international and comparative history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jefferson Cowie.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And it's an extraordinary time the election year has already begun.
Unbelievable.
A year early. Billions are going to be spent. And the extraordinary thing is that the Democrats still seem to be unable to distinguish themselves from the Republican narrative, and particularly the Reagan narrative. And so many people in the White House, these kind of wusses like Goolsbee and Cass Sunstein, seem to bend over backwards to sacrifice any social programs, willingly putting them up for sacrifice, it seems, and preemptively doing so. So do you think there is a possibility that the Democrats can defend the legacy of FDR before it's gone?
Well, you use the word narrative, the Reagan narrative, and that the Democrats really don't have an alternative story. And I really think that is our biggest problem. So when, the Democratic Party that is now the child of the DLC moved right to accommodate itself to Reaganism, it lost its story. And its story was, capitalism had a huge crisis in the 1930s. The Democratic Party glued the system back together and provided security for working people across the board. And now they've got nothing. And I think until the Democrats and the labor movement come up with some kind of narrative, they're going to continue to capitulate ground. And implicit in your question is, can they revive sort of New Dealism? I actually think that one's spent. I think that one's over. I think, and that's what the Long Exceptions study is about. And we need to think about an alternative framework that can actually go head to head with the new right's kind of, conspiratorial, anti-statist, individualist, Christian white republic story. Otherwise, we ain't got nothing.
Well, it's just amazing to watch the narrative be captured by the right, the deficit crisis instead of the revenue crisis, which is what the reality is, and the notion that working Americans and the American middle class have to make further sacrifices of what little social programs they have in order to accommodate this mythical looming deficit, as opposed to the narrative that the Democrats should be out there with, which is getting people back to work and creating jobs and restoring the middle class. That's the part of it I don't understand. Couldn't you make a case that the American dream is based on the middle class, and we're going to fight like hell to restore the middle class, and we're sick of you guys giving billionaires tax breaks, which is, frankly, your entire economic program?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for somebody to get out a sort of Ross Perot-like chart and say, look, here's how much you folks made of the pie 30, 40 years ago. Here's how much of the pie you get today. And the rest of it goes to these fat cats. But nobody is actually stepping up and really talking about inequality, which is the fundamental problem of the entire political economy today. It's what got us into the crisis of 2008. It's what continues to create the jobs crisis, and all of this. But you're right that it continues to be a story wrapped around, well, whatever is good for the corporations is good for everybody else, and that actually might have had some traction in the post-war era, but not anymore, and we need to really get over that.
Again, I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, professor of history at Cornell University and author of Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. So let's talk about that, Jefferson, given that wages have been flat since the 1970s. And one of the subtexts of Reaganism was, of course, to introduce cheap credit, which he did through Ayn Rand's acolyte, the head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan. So they made cheap money available, which then the banks, you know, the banks got it at 2 or 3%, and they loaned it out at 18.5%.
Right.
One hell of a deal. And they got the entire working class and middle class in this country hooked on credit, which gave them the illusion that their standard of living was being maintained, but their wages were flat.
That's right.
It's quite a con, isn't it?
Yeah, my friend Tom Gagin says that workers lost their union cards just in time to pick up their credit cards. And I think that's a pretty pithy version of what happened in the late 70s and on through the 1980s. And we see the costs of that massive credit bubble today.
Just an aside, Jefferson, I did an interview the other day about this. The student debt in this country is greater than the credit card debt. And that is an absolute highway robbery. What's happening here is that the Congress is letting these phony for-profit schools take $40 billion of taxpayers' money, which they charge back to these kids and give them a worthless education and put them in debt for life. And guess who in the Congress is protecting these sharks in the for-profit colleges?
That's right. Well,
the Democrats, largely.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it affects even elite education. I don't want to have any crocodile tears for graduates of Ivy League institutions like I teach at. But I even think about these guys. They walk out with a staggering debt load. Their options are foreclosed. They're not going to go to, you know, go do what actually might move them, what might actually have some meaning in their lives, what might have social implications for the rest of the country. They have to go to the highest bidder because the price of education has outstripped the rate of inflation. And so they borrowed all this money, and they're saddled with this debt, and they've basically mortgaged their own futures for even the best education.
Well, again, you sort of ask rhetorically, why not the narrative, we're going to restore the American dream? And part of the American dream was the GI Bill and cheap, good education.
Right. Upward mobility.
Which
ironically is now more available in Europe. The American dream of upward mobility is more available to Europeans than it is in the United States. We are in an age where class matters more materially, but less in terms of the way we imagine our society, the way we think about our politics, than any time since the Industrial Revolution.
So again, the notion that nobody wants to step up and say, you know, it's time for the billionaires to make some sacrifices.
That's class warfare, Ian. We don't.
But how could a guy like Paul Ryan, who apparently forces the rest his congressional staff to read The Fountainhead, and he comes up with this plan to put all the seniors on vouchers, which would be worthless, and their Medicare will disappear, and what little savings they get will be eaten up in no time because of the exorbitant cost of medicine. At the same time, he wants to give an extra tax cut to the billionaires. And then along comes another presidential candidate, Tim Pawlenty, who wants to make even more tax cuts for the billionaires. And people are treating these people seriously.
Yeah, well, back to that narrative question, and I'm a bit of a follower of George Lakoff on this, the use of metaphor and narrative and signs and symbols in political discourse. Those really matter. And if we don't take those seriously, we're going to lose. And so to go up against that kind of political discourse solely with facts and figures and rational arguments isn't going to do it. You know, we sit there and scratch our heads at how this all works. How can everything be so crazy? But I think it's largely because they have a pretty good story, and all we have is, and this is going to sound silly, but all we have is empirical, rational reasoning on our side. But I think they have mythology, and we need to come up with a counter story. And you know, they go all the way back to the use of the term tyranny, and Obama's a socialist, he's a fascist, and the Tea Party is revolting against a tyrannical government. Those myths go very, very deep, and I think until we really figure out a way to structure a different story we're going to continue to play a sort of a rear guard struggle.
So, Jefferson Carey, since you're an historian, you're not saying that in terms of the Lakoff theory of emotional intelligence, that when a Sarah Palin says that Paul Revere was actually warning the British, not the American colonials, and when Michelle Bachmann says that the founding fathers worked mightily to stop slavery, which, you know, is so pathetically wrong. I mean, in other words, is public education so bad in this country, or in this inexorable drift towards where faith replaces facts? Is it such that you can't correct people like Palin? And because when she was on Fox, she didn't even correct herself. She dug the hole deeper. But you know.
But it doesn't seem to matter.
Well, that's my question. You know.
Right. So I'm not advocating we just all argue mythologies, but I think the facts and the interpretations and the figures that progressives want to put forward needs to fit into a larger analytical and narrative framework. And that, you know, and her, you know, the silliness of, you know, the muffed up Paul Revere story or any of that other stuff works because, you know, as soon as she says it, it connects to a series of other themes and issues, even her being attacked by the, you know, elite media. And there's not a counter story. So I want to be very clear. I don't want to, you know, trade in myth, but we need to begin to talk about big stories like security, like advancing the middle class, or the working class even. FDR, what really gave him traction in the 1930s was the term security. It wasn't called Social Security for nothing. That really was the dominant metaphorical theme that provided the types of political support he got.
Well, I think there's no greater mythology, if you will, than the American dream, as opposed to the American reality. And idea that these plutocrats can hijack this Tea Party movement and have all these useful idiots, out there, you know, demanding tax cuts for the billionaires, is breathtaking.
I agree, but I want to challenge you on one thing, Ian, and that is, you know, they do seem idiotic, but I think another way to think about it, you know, because we have to figure out how to advance this, right, is to say, okay, there's a certain democratic populist potential there. These guys believe themselves to be fighting some kind of tyranny. They've got it all wrong, right? And else is completely wrong. But I think there's an impulse there that the left could begin to take advantage of. And we need to begin to think about how to tap into those feelings and those same sentiments and bring them toward more constructive ends than, you know, dressing up Obama in a Nazi uniform, you know.
Well, let's go back to your historian hat here, Jefferson Carey. There was a time, a lot of historians say that we're in a new Gilded Age, and the disparity of wealth would indicate that we are. And the power of the plutocrats is such that in many ways you can question now whether we are the democracy that we think we are and whether we're heading towards a kind of plutonomy ruled by oligarchs. And it's certainly pretty clear that the power of money now is greater than the power of votes.
Yep.
And that's a scary...
It's anonymous, practically.
Yeah. So, exactly. So there was a time back in the original Gilded Age when populism was on the left, and so was religion. There was a religious left under Williams Jennings Bryan, and of course the plutocrats outspent them enormously and won that election. But whatever happened to that form of populism, where you had the rural poor and the urban poor united around religion and class justice, for the want of a better description?
Right. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I do believe I use the term the new Gilded Age myself. I think it's sort of a valuable way to think about it. because of, you know, the staggering levels of inequality, the way money rules. You know, they used to have those cartoons, those great cartoons of the big money bags in the Senate who were running the Senate in the 1890s. And, you know, but here we are with a Gilded Age, you know, without a William Jennings Bryan, without a Eugene Debs, without a Pullman strike or a Homestead strike or a, you know, Mary Leese or any of these other great socialist and populist figures. Okay, so what's different? I think that trying to pinpoint the differences there is absolutely important. And what gave rise to the Progressive Era, that is the time of reform that followed the Gilded Age, was basically a sense that we can't have these types of upheavals and this sort of naked class conflict in the streets that really was, and in the farms, in the rural areas, that we saw in the Gilded Age. So the middle class began to say, all right, we need to reform. And Teddy Roosevelt came along and began to talk about balancing the power of corporations with the power of the state and using the power of the state as a vehicle for people's voices, which really had never been done before since Jackson, really. Mm. But it was really the pressure that came from below there. But what we have to remember is marbled in that whole kind of progressive socialist populist vision was the same sort of conspiracy, paranoia, sense of struggle against tyranny that we see today. It's just the balance has flipped towards kind of the crazy conspiratorial theories and away from the social justice mission. Always sort of hand in hand in American history has been the kind of darker side, even in those more progressive areas. There's always kind of not far below, you know, was this other element in American history. You mentioned William Jennings Bryan. Let's not forget he's also the guy who defended
creationism
in the Scopes trial, right? So they're connected. And you know, Richard Hofstadter had this famous essay that he wrote in 63 or 64, the paranoid style in American politics, and he traced this vein through American history. And I actually don't like his sort of clinical approach. You know, he actually said, I don't mean this in a clinical way, paranoid, but I actually think that there's a democratic impulse even within that paranoia, that people in America are afraid of consolidation of power. Right now they just don't understand that the consolidation of power is within the corporation. And that is really has to be the focus of our analysis.
Teddy Roosevelt, of course, was an accidental president.
Right.
And McKinley was shot.
Right.
And they only put him on the ticket to balance the ticket and make it look good. And I'm sure they weren't happy with what happened there. And
no, they were very pleased that cowboy was in the office.
Right. And I think in many ways you could argue that President Obama was a kind of accidental president. It was largely because of what a disaster Bush was.
I actually believe that.
My question is, do you think that in spite of all the disappointment, do you think that there's any way that Obama could become Teddy Roosevelt? Because we sure as hell need Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, you know, I appreciate that question because the question has always been, would Obama become FDR? You know, and he was even on the cover of Time or Newsweek, I can't remember which, sitting in the open-air limo with a cigarette holder and with the big toothy grin like FDR. And the whole time I was like, no, we don't need FDR. We need Teddy Roosevelt. And my biggest disappointment with Obama is that he has not made the argument that the state is a place where people can actually address their issues, that the state can play a positive role in people's lives. He's, you know, he just signed up Goldman Sachs for his cabinet instead. And I had very low expectations. I thought he'd be an effective neoliberal president. But I did think that he might make that TR kind of move. And I'm very disappointed that he has not.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jefferson Cowie.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jefferson Cowie. He's a professor of history at Cornell University. He's the author of Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor, The Long Exception and Interpretation of the New Deal from FDR to Obama, and Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our production intern is Graham Fitzgibbons. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. You can also check out my blog at ianmasters.com and leave comments. I'd love to know what you think. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I